our series in which we have met Jesus through the Gospels. If you're visiting with us, especially for Easter, we are really, really glad to have you here. You can listen to the other sermons online if you'd like to. But we've been working through a series in which we've seen John and Matthew and Luke introduce us to this person of Jesus who changed their life. We've looked at Jesus, this divine become flesh, fully God and fully human. Jesus, the Messiah, the one who had been promised that was going to come and rescue Israel specifically and humanity generally. But he was so much more than what they expected. Last week we spent time in Luke looking at Jesus as the king. Not necessarily the king they wanted, but the king that we need. And then Friday, we gathered together with a couple of other churches, and Reverend William Min reminded us that Jesus, this one who is God, this one who is Messiah, this one who is King, willingly chose to go to the cross. He embraced life-giving self-sacrifice because of his love for us, so that we can live and so that we can see what true love looks like. Today, we're going to jump into the Gospel of Mark and his introduction to Jesus. But before we do that, I have to ask, has anybody here do puzzles ever? Has anybody ever done a puzzle? You know, you spend 2, 3, 20 hours putting together your several thousand pieces, the several thousand piece puzzle, you know, the picture of the London Tower or whatever you're putting the, and then you get to the end and you realize there's one piece missing. That sums up how we feel. You've had that experience. Or maybe you've been just totally sucked into this episode of your favorite TV show, and just when it's getting to this climactic point, the words "to be continued" come up on the screen. You're like, ah! Had that feeling? The Gospel of Mark is kind of like that. Before we explore it too deeply, I want to take us to the end of the Gospel of Mark, at the last chapter, Mark 16. In most translations, most English translations that we have from the past 40 years, when you get to Mark 16, you can look there in your Bible if you'd like, you get down to verse 8, and then it kind of, there's a line there, or it stops, or the text changes, or there's some type of note there. The NIV, the note after chapter or after verse 8, says the earliest manuscripts and some other ancient witnesses do not have Mark 16:9-20. Did you see something like that in your Bible? There's some type of note or footnote saying, yeah, actually, the earliest stuff doesn't have this. There's also, in some translations, there's a footnote because there's an alternative shorter ending that some other manuscripts have. Without going into all the detail, it is important for us to note that the most reliable manuscripts of the Gospel of Mark don't have anything after verse 8. The ending that we have is verse 8. Well, I'll read the last three verses. Basically, the ending we have has these women going to the tomb on Sunday morning to anoint Jesus' body, basically to help with the smell of a dead body. And they get there and the stone's rolled away and they're shocked. They enter into the tomb and they see this angel, a young man dressed in a white robe, it's described. And the message is this: "Don't be alarmed," he said. "You're looking for Jesus the Nazarene who was crucified. He has risen. He is not here. See the place where they laid him. But go tell his disciples and Peter, he's going ahead of you into Galilee. There you will see him, just as he told you." Trembling and bewildered, the women went out and fled from the tomb. They said nothing to anyone because they were afraid. End scene. End story. That's all we have. This unfinished puzzle, this to be continued story with, and Mark doesn't write a next episode. As people who don't tend to like unfinished puzzles, I saw your reaction when I even talked about that possibility. We don't tend to like stories with awkward endings. And so it makes sense to us that at some point people said, "We don't like this. There has to be something more." So they added endings later on. They added pieces to try and resolve this awkward, difficult ending. Now, whether or not there was originally a different ending to Mark that somehow got lost, because they worked on scrolls, and sometimes on scrolls the top and the bottom would kind of wear off. And so there are some who say we think there was a different ending. Whether or not there was a different ending, what we do know is this. This is the earliest ending we have. And early Christians were so uncomfortable with this ending that they added other endings to try and wrap up the story. But before we wrestle with this ending, let's consider the beginning. In the beginning, God made the heaven and the earth. That is to say, God is the source. He was the source of all that is. The first chapters of the Bible share with beautiful poetry and powerful imagery the picture of God forming and giving life to the world that we know. And that life is very much a literal life. There's stars and orbits and plants and animals and ultimately humanity. But it's also a spiritual life. The divine observes that this creation is good. It bears within it the spark of the Creator, and people are given a unique place within this created world to carry the divine image out as image bearers. And we're given this task to foster the goodness of God within the world and help it to thrive. Remember this story, beginning of the Bible, Genesis 1 and 2? I find it amazing that in the beginning, the instructions for how to foster the goodness of God are really simple. It's actually one instruction. Don't eat from the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. One thing, and it was a what not to do, not even a what you had to do. I'm not a gardener, but I think the main reason is because the list of things I have to do to maintain a garden and help it to thrive is just overwhelming to me. And yet they've been tasked with helping this whole thing to thrive, and the only task they're given is don't eat from that one tree. It seems that at the beginning, the tendency of creation is towards the goodness that God has observed in it. And as long as humanity doesn't introduce this thing that's not good, that the task of helping it to thrive and flourish is going to be a joyful one and not a complicated one. But, we, humanity, fails. We introduce that which is not good. And with that, we introduce death. And this death, like the life that was, is both a literal one and a spiritual one, a physical one and a spiritual one. Humanity is put on the road towards a very literal death, and on that road a deep shadow has been cast over the divine spark that once shone so brightly in the world. These people that were tasked with maintaining that spark and helping creation to thrive, they themselves devolve into darkness as their bodies break down and relationships break down and blame and accusation and envy and hatred and conflict grow. God is not absent there, but he and the life that comes with him, it's pushed aside by the darkness. In the earliest chapters of the Bible, it talks about this darkness growing and this death pervading things to such an extent that by the time you get to Genesis 6:5, it says that every inclination of the thoughts of the human heart was only evil all the time. For the sake of time, I can't rehearse the whole story between then and Jesus, but the picture is consistently a drive, a tendency towards death. Every time God breaks in and gives invitations into life, people turn it back around towards death again. God offers his people freedom, and they choose the bondage of other gods. God offers his people a law that's meant to help them live in ways that offer justice and life to them and the people around them. And they turn that law into a weapon to use against each other and abuse each other. God offers his people a connection with him, his kingship, and they chase after human kings. And it results in perpetual slavery and conflict, which eventually divides the kingdom, and the kingdom finally falls to foreign invaders. No matter what tastes of life humanity is offered, the end result seems to be the same. They turn it towards death. It's no wonder they adopt eventually a sense of futility. Isaiah says that the song of the day in his world was, "Let us eat and drink, for tomorrow we die." We're going on that road anyway, so we may as well have fun on the way. Because no matter how much life is sown, no matter how much life is shared, it all still ends in death. Into this world filled with entropy and tendency towards chaos and death, Jesus comes on the scene. And from the earliest pages of Mark's gospel, Jesus is offering something different. We're just going to really quickly highlight a bunch of the stuff that happens in the gospel of Mark. Because Mark is this fast-paced action book where it just goes from one thing to the next to the next. And it seems like at every page there's something else where Jesus is offering life in the middle of this darkness. We're introduced to Jesus when he comes up out of the water to being baptized by John. He's engaging in this symbol that symbolizes life. And Jesus participates in that. And he goes announcing the good news. And then you get to verse 21. And one of the first things he does is he goes into this place where it talks about someone being possessed by an evil spirit. This spirit that is carrying death and chaos with him. And Jesus meets with this spirit and casts him out and brings peace where there was conflict, life where there was death. In verse 29 of Mark, he leaves the synagogue, goes out, finds Simon's mother-in-law in bed with a fever, and he helps her to come back to health and life. Verse 32, that evening after sunset, the people brought to Jesus all the sick and demon-possessed, and Jesus healed many who had various diseases and drove out many demons. Verse 40, he meets with a man who has leprosy and cleanses him. The beginning of chapter 2, he actually has men come and bring to him someone who is paralyzed, and he offers forgiveness of sin and healing of this one who can't walk. Chapter 2, verse 13 gets interesting because he goes and calls as one of his followers somebody who had forsaken all the ways that their people thought gave life. And he's aligned with the Roman Empire, and he's chasing after money and wealth, and Jesus says, "You, come follow me." And he goes with him to eat, and he's facing criticism from the Pharisees and the Sadducees, the people who are there thinking they're supposed to be protecting the life of God. Jesus aligns with people on the other side and offers life to those who had been written off by the gatekeepers. He embraces in verse 23 to the end of chapter 2, he embraces life-giving instead of the law when he lets his disciples gather food to eat even on the Sabbath. The metaphors that you get, let's skip over to chapter 4. The metaphors that he uses are all life-giving metaphors. The first 20 verses, he talks about seed that bears harvest, where the farmer goes out and sows, and it grows up into this great life. In verse 21 to 25, it's about lamps and lights that cast out the darkness. In verse 30 to 32, it's about this mustard seed. Anybody seen a mustard seed? Tiny little mustard seed that grows up into this tree that offers shade and a home and a place for the birds to settle. The end of chapter 4, Jesus is on a boat with his disciples and a storm comes up. The chaos of a stormy sea was one of the almost universal symbols of death and destruction that existed in the ancient world. And Jesus goes into that and says, "Peace, be still," and calms it. Has power even over that. These things continue throughout the book. Dramatic healings in chapter 5, including raising a girl from the dead. He empowers his followers to spread this kind of life in Mark 6. Also in Mark 6, he feeds 5,000 people. He walks on water. He calms the wind on the seas. This life-giving work goes on and on throughout the book, and people start to follow him and pay attention because here is someone in the midst of everything going towards death. He is giving life. They want that life. At the very least, they want the show that goes along with him offering life. But there's an interesting twist in the middle of it. Jesus regularly gives instructions to people who receive this taste of life from him. In Mark 1:34, Jesus casts out demons, but then it says he would not let the demons speak because they knew who he was. In Mark 1:44, he heals this man who has leprosy, the skin disease, and then says, "See that you don't tell this to anyone." In Mark 3:12, Jesus again dealing with people who are possessed by evil spirits, and we're told that he gave them strict orders not to tell others about him. In Mark 5:43, he raises a girl from the dead, then turns to those people who just witnessed this and says that he commanded them, or sorry, gave them strict orders not to tell anyone about it. He heals a man who is deaf and mute, and then turns to all of the witnesses of this act and says that it says that they commanded them not to tell anyone. Even when Peter declares that Jesus is the Messiah, says that Jesus warned them not to tell anyone about him. And then Mark 9:9, what we call the transfiguration happens, where this amazing scene that where Jesus transforms momentarily, and then the voice of God speaks out of the cloud affirming Jesus. The disciples, Peter, James, and John, who witnessed this event, are trying to make sense of it, and Jesus gives them orders not to tell anyone what they had seen until the Son of Man had been risen from the dead. He's giving these glimpses of life all over the place, and he continually saying, but don't tell anyone. Shh, keep it under your hat. Now, very rarely do they, but he's telling them not to do it. But they do tell. People do want to share. Because the kind of life that Jesus was giving, the healing from leprosy, the even raising from the dead, as unbelievable as it was something that people could make sense of. They could make sense of the fact that this one who was controlled by this horrible spirit that made them uncontrollable is now at peace. It's beautiful. We can hold on to that and say, look what Jesus did. But that doesn't change the overall path that humanity is on. That is still on this road to end in death. This leper being healed of his skin disease, it's amazing for him, it's amazing for his family and friends, but ultimately it's a temporary blip on the tendency towards disorder and chaos. Even feeding 4,000 or 5,000 people, because both of those happen in this gospel, from one person's small lunch, it's a mind-blowing gift of life, but in 4 to 6 hours, what's going to be going on with those people? They're going to be hungry again. If they're teenage boys, then maybe 20 minutes. Ultimately, it doesn't ultimately adjust the trajectory of things. And then, as the story moves on, the life giver is arrested. Even his life falls victim to the chaos and disorder and death that's coming after us all. He's put on trial. The crowds who loved his healing and his love, they now turn on him and call for his crucifixion. He's considered innocent by Pilate, the Roman governor and judge, and yet he is handed over to a brutal beating and death. The taste of life he offered is now gone. It's been swept away by the inevitability and permanency of death, spiritual and physical, that someday we all have to taste it. Maybe they weren't supposed to tell anyone because it was in fact too good to be true. When you get to chapter 15 of the Gospel of Mark, Jesus dies and is buried in a tomb. And that would be a logical end to the story. The stone over the entrance of a tomb, the final puzzle piece put in place to give us the picture of this one who offered life, but ended the way we all do, in death. But it's not the end of the story. The women approach the tomb thinking they're helping to preserve the body of one whose story is over. And they're faced with this shocking to-be-continued message. A message they couldn't have seen coming and didn't make any sense. His death was tragic, but it makes sense in our world. Even today, it makes sense. But instead, they're met by an angel who says, "Don't be alarmed. You're looking for Jesus who was crucified. He has risen. He's not here." Resurrection? Jesus alive? That was impossible. That's like completing your puzzle, stepping back, and then realizing it's actually supposed to be three-dimensional. It's like including a lengthy and emotional movie and finding out that it's just a prequel to a whole series of films. In the face of this declaration, these women are told, okay, here's the good news, here's what you need to believe, and go tell other people. And in that moment, says, trembling and bewildered, the women went out, fled from the tomb. They said nothing to anyone because they were afraid. We know from other gospel writers and from history that the stories of these women didn't end with that fear. It didn't end with them not saying anything. I imagine these women, overwhelmed by this news they've heard, fleeing and you know, they're running in panic, and people are seeing them saying, "What's going on?" And they're just holding it in because they don't even know what to say. They just are running with fear in their eyes, and they get back to one of their homes and they're debriefing, and they're faced with these questions. Do we believe that it's true? This resurrection, should we believe this announcement? Maybe it's just too good to be true, but if it is true, it changes everything. Do we believe it? And if they believe it, should they actually embrace it? Because it's one thing to believe it, like, okay, yeah, it's possible, but it's a whole nother thing to actually want to have anything to do with it. Because if Jesus is alive, the people who wanted him dead before are going to keep coming after him. And if they align with him, then that's going to put them in the line of fire. They'll become targets too. At best, they'll be considered outcasts or crazy. Maybe it's better just to ignore him and hide. But if they believe it, and if they receive it, they've been told to go tell people. They've been told to go tell the other disciples about this resurrection. Should they share that news? Life in another world after death, this idea that we can live forever in heaven, that's one thing. You know, even the Pharisees believe that. But actual resurrection life, that's different than just life after death in some other world. Like, life after death in this world, telling that story could make them a laughingstock. But if it's true, and they're going to actually enter into it, should they not share it with others? Mark's introduction that ends with this, here's the announcement, go tell, and they're left holding this news, not sure what to do with it. It leaves us kind of with that same question. They're running away in fear over the strange radical announcement, this life-shaking, this world-transforming announcement, and we are left with the same questions. Will we believe this announcement that Jesus is alive, that he is resurrected from the dead, that death, spiritual and physical, is no longer an inevitability, that all of life doesn't have to just keep going down this train to death, going down those tracks to death? That are we willing to believe that there is hope beyond the evil and darkness of the world, and that there's hope beyond the bitter pain of death? Will we believe that God in the flesh, this promised Messiah, this King like no other, initiated victory over death and changed the trajectory of the world from slowly dying into slowly moving towards resurrection life? Will we believe it? Dare we believe it? Eyewitness testimonies tell us that it is true. But the question comes to each of us, will you and will I believe it? And if we believe it's true, will we actually receive it? Will we actually choose the way of Jesus? Will we choose to follow him into the way of life that has both immediate and eternal impact? Will we choose to stake our life on this claim that Jesus is alive, and we are going to participate in that life with him? And if we believe it and if we receive it, will we stake our life on it in such a way that we will, of course, then share it? Will we tell others this crazy news that Jesus is alive? Will we invite others to believe and receive this good news? You know, next week, we're going to continue the story. We're going to jump into the book of Acts, where we see what happened when Jesus' followers believed, received, and shared the good news. To put it mildly, it changed the world. But the question we need to ask is, will we join in sharing that good news that Jesus is alive, both in what we say and how we live? In his commentary on Mark, Tom Wright, N.T. Wright, wrote this. He said, "There's a blank at the end of the story, and we are invited to fill it in ourselves. Do we take Easter for granted? Or have we found ourselves awestruck at the strange new work of God? What do we know of the risen Lord? Where is he going ahead of us? What tasks does he have for us to undertake today, to take this gospel of the kingdom, this good news of the resurrection, to the ends of the earth?" We're left with this puzzle piece that's not filled in because it's our task to create what that puzzle piece looks like. It's to be continued, and our lives are left to take the story forward. We get to write what is next. Jesus is alive. What's our story going to tell going forward? Let's continue to the service and sing some songs of celebration together.